For the week of June 3rd, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 150, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And hanging out on Airtime online, I'm Michael Giltz, because Airtime is super cool.
What are you talking about?
Airtime, the new thing launched by Sean Parker and the guy from Napster.
Oh, really? Well, Sean Parker, of course, is one of the co-founders of Napster.
And Facebook, more to the point. That's where he made his money.
Well, yes, that's true.
Yeah, so he and Fanning launched this thing called Airtime, which sounds like chat roulette, but it's nothing like chat roulette, they say, where you get to talk to your friends via video and meet strangers if you have the same profiles and stuff and are interested, but it's not all sex like chat roulette. And they were launching it today or yesterday, and the New York Times had an interview, and they said, talking to Sean Parker at his five-story apartment in Manhattan.
Wow, five-story apartment.
I say, if it's five stories, it's not an apartment.
No, that's a townhouse.
It's a townhouse. It's a home. It's a behemoth. Whatever it is, it ain't an apartment.
So he teamed up with Sean Fanning, who was the Harvard University dropout who created Napster with Sean Parker.
Right. They had talked to the guy who was doing chat roulette, but ended up not doing something with him. And now they've come up with Airtime. It's keyed up with Facebook, I believe, so that you can use it via Facebook to chat with your friends. But somehow they think it's going to be easier and better than Skype and other stuff. I don't know why they think it's going to get any traction, but they do.
Wow. Okay. Well, of course, Sean Parker is Justin Timberlake, really. We all know that, right?
He wishes.
Well, if he was played by Justin Timberlake in The Social Network. Now, I'm going to have to excuse myself very early on here, because while I was in Cannes, Bruce Kirkland of the Toronto Star, the entertainment journalist and movie critic from the Toronto Star, suggested that I go with him to the free coffee bar at the Wi-Fi cafe there in the Palais. And he said, oh, you should have a cup of coffee. Now, the coffee in Cannes, or at least at the Palais, is these short little small cups of what I assume is espresso.
Mm-hmm.
And I never, ever drink coffee. I am not a coffee drinker at all.
So you were up for 14 days straight?
And I became so addicted to this coffee. I would go 2-3 times a day. And so then I get back to the States last week, and I'm drinking coffee. I'm going down to the Starbucks. I'm asking them, what's an espresso? What's an Americano? So a latte has what in it again? And so yesterday, for 2 days, I didn't have any. I crashed so hard. I was leveled. And then today, I said, okay, I've got to get rid of this headache. Went down to Starbucks and got an Americano, which apparently is just hot water and espresso. And now I'm just wired.
All right. Well, I blame Bruce Kirkland. I blame Canada.
You blame Canada. That's right. Bruce Kirkland is from the Toronto Star. So you can blame all of Canada on that. But, you know, the good news is that will help us get through today's or this week's news stories a lot faster. And on today's show, we will be filling you in on the Hollywood veteran that is taking over the reins at Disney, Robert Iger, who is the CEO of Disney. His new hire has many in Hollywood sitting up and taking notice. We'll also, of course, discuss a few news stories like the upcoming Tony Awards before we move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. We'll end with a little inside baseball where we'll let you know about what everyone is saying about how the relationship between Hollywood and Silicon Valley is about piracy these days. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office around the world is still Will Smith's Men in Black 3. It made another $108 million worldwide. It's grossed $387 million and counting. Like a lot of his movies, it's proven a lot more popular overseas than it is in North America. Here in the U.S., it's grossed about $112 million. Overseas, it's grossed about $270 million. At number two around the world is Snow White and the Huntsman, which was quite a bit of a roll of the dice, and it's got to be a little sigh of relief for the people at
Universal.
Yeah. Because they've had a little trouble with Battleship and some other movies. And now finally, they've got some pretty good news. Snow White and the Huntsman opened to $95 million around the world. It was the number one movie in North America, almost doubling the gross of Men in Black 3. And it had a strong debut overseas. It cost $170 million to make, so we'll have to see how good the hold is. But at least they opened the film and aren't frightened already. And number three around the world is Prometheus, the Ridley Scott film that is somewhat of a prequel to Alien. It grossed $35 million. It played in key territories around the world. It hasn't opened in North America yet, but overseas it's trying to beat the rush before soccer kicks in. Euro Cup is coming up in June, and that's going to just depress box office for the next 4 weeks. So Prometheus wanted to get in some quick bucks before that happened. And in the territories where it opened, like the UK, it did extremely well, crushed the movies in its path. So it's had a very strong debut in what we'll call a worldwide limited release.
Well, and frankly, the UK specifically had a 4-day weekend because of the Diamond Jubilee for the Queen.
That's right. My mother is on the Thames yesterday watching, you know, the flotilla go up the thing, and Hyde Park watching people run around with flags. So she's having a grand old time in England. So it's a national, you know, holiday hysteria going on right now there.
Well, I hope she had an umbrella because it's pouring over there right now.
No. Yeah, that was during the flotilla. Today it was lovely.
Okay.
The next day was lovely. Today, well, lovely by English standards, of course, means it's a little drizzly and gray. But yes, no, it's been the whole country's come to a standstill. It's really, you can watch it here in America on BBC America, and certainly the morning news channels and the 24-hour cable channels were covering it, at length. Jon Stewart made fun of it. And if Jon Stewart makes fun of it, you know you've really done something.
I thought Jon Stewart's take on this was hilarious.
It was.
He was saying, you know, they broke in not to talk about a horrible airplane crash in Nigeria, a huge tragedy, but to talk about how the flyover over the Thames of the Royal Air Force was called off because due to weather.
Yes, well, yeah, there you go. Got to keep your priorities straight.
Yeah.
And number four around the world is The Avengers, another $32 million worldwide. It's at $1.355 billion. It is now officially the third biggest film of all time worldwide. It's grossed $800 million overseas, $552 million in North America. At number five around the world is Dark Shadows, $11 million worldwide. It's at $191 million and struggling to get to $200 million, which is, according to some people, just about close to what it cost. It cost officially $150 million to make, probably a little bit more. At number six is The Dictator, the Sacha Baron Cohen comedy, which has been falling fast. That made another $11 million worldwide. It's at $111 million and counting. And number seven is What to Expect When You're Expecting. That has made $8 million worldwide for a small, modest $39 million and counting. Number eight, oh, heavens to Betsy. What did Battleship make? I've messed up my numbers on Battleship. And number nine is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which grossed $4.6 million. That passed the $100 million mark last week. It's now at $107 million. And number 10, roughly, is Chernobyl Diaries, which grossed another $3 million. It's at $14 million worldwide and counting. Battleship is at about $252 million worldwide counting.
Yeah, and it made between $4.6 and $8 million worldwide this week because,
That's right.
Yeah.
It made $4.8 million here in the U.S. It's almost completely done. I think the interesting news is that Prometheus made, I think in the U.K., like 75% of its ticket sales were for 3D.
Oh, really?
So that's a little figure I saw about the 3D demand for Prometheus. If nothing else, the movie is supposed to look good.
Yes, that is true. Well, and it has Charlize Theron, so, you know, of course it looks good.
Well, yes, but looks good even in 3D. You know, some people say the 3D is worth it. I'm not sure if that's true, but I will tell you that you don't have to stay to the end of the credits if you go see Prometheus. Why? Because there is no kicker. I've spoken to someone who saw the official final print. They stay to the end of the credits. They say there is no kicker in Prometheus. So if you go, you can relax. You can walk out of the theater as soon as the credits begin, if you're so inclined, without having to feel you'd be cheated out of some one last little tidbit. That's why, in fact, I've started a Twitter feed, as if I don't have enough going on in my life. I've got a Twitter feed called Kicker No Kicker. It's at Kicker No Kicker 1, the number 1. You know, so if you go to Twitter and look for at Kicker No Kicker 1, you will find my Twitter feed, or you can go to my Twitter feed, Michael Giltz, and look at my friends and find Kicker No Kicker in there. We'll also include a link in the show notes. All I'm going to do is post whether there's a kicker in a movie or not. I'm sick of not knowing. I sat through the Lorax credits, and even though it had been out for a couple weeks, because I didn't know if there was a kicker. So Moonrise Kingdom, by the way, has an audio kicker, a song that's played over the end credits in the middle that's sort of funny and ties into what was going on in the movie. That's an audio kicker, thanks to my friend Aaron, who has been a guest on the show, who let me know about that. And, of course, we all know that The Avengers has two kickers, one in the middle of the credits, one at the end. But again, down the road, Prometheus, no kicker. And if you want to know if a movie has a kicker, if you see a movie on opening weekend and want to tell us, like Snow White and the Huntsman, I don't know. Does that have a kicker? I haven't heard from anybody yet. I imagine it doesn't, but I don't know.
Now, so a kicker is a kicker, just to clarify, a kicker is that drink that you take, you know, it's the thing that, like, if you do a shot of whiskey, then you have, like, a beer kicker, right? Oh, no, that's a chaser, isn't it?
We're not all alcoholics. A kicker is something that appears during the closing credits or after the very end of the closing credits, a final little tidbit of fun.
You see how, like, I got you to explain that for our audience? You see how I kind of, you know.
I saw how you did that. Ferris Bueller's Day Is Off had a nice kicker. You know, all the credits went through, and at the very end, Matthew Broderick shuffles out in a bathroom. It's like, go home. What are you doing? Why are you still here? Get out of here. Go. Very amusing. A lot of movies have it. They're very popular in animated films. Superhero movies often have a little kicker, a little teaser. You know, there's just, but there are dramas and comedies as well that will have kickers in them. So, you know, it's just nice to know whether you need to hang out. You know, it's because credits can be 6, 7, 8 minutes long, especially if a big elaborate movie like Avengers. It's nice to know, hey, if you hang out to the last, you know, 5 minutes, you're going to see something.
I would say Ferris Bueller's Day Off is one of the best example of that. And of course, the Muppets always have those like bloopers that they do.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, you know, but some of those begin as soon as the credits begin.
Yes.
So that's not a surprise. But sometimes you just don't know if there's a kicker or not.
Now, what was the, I didn't know you were doing this, but so what was the impetus for this? What made you go?
Because I sat through the Lorax and was like, God sakes, why don't I know whether there's a kicker or not? You know, I'm just sick of not knowing.
Okay. So, and why kicker, no kicker one? Why the one?
Well, it was kicker, no kicker, but for some reason they put a one on it. Don't ask me why. What are you going to do?
That's very odd. I wonder if you could call them on that.
Call them? What am I going to call them? But anyway, there you go. So look in the show notes and you can see if there's a kicker or no kicker and let us know. The big thing is, you know, if you see a new movie and we haven't posted yet, I'll retweet your tweet and let people know whether there's a kicker or not.
Well, now, speaking of seeing movies, did you see Snow White and the Huntsman?
No, I didn't. I didn't see anything this weekend.
Okay. So what do you think? I mean, a $56 million opening here domestically in North America, and people are saying, hey, that's a good opening. And others are saying, well, Universal kind of dampened expectations by saying, we think it will do $40 million in its opening weekend, so that when it did 50, everybody would be saying, oh, what a huge hit this is.
Well, I mean, Kristen Stewart and Hemsworth are not exactly big stars. She hasn't really opened anything other than Twilight movies. He's been in, you know, big name properties, so he hasn't really shown whether he can carry a movie.
And this is Hemsworth, the actor that played Thor.
That's right. So, I mean, you know, this is a good non-franchise movie for them to both star in and open. So it's a solid opening. These aren't proven stars yet. They're people who've been in big movies. I mean, Twilight has grossed like $1 billion in North America, but she's still not a big draw that we know if she's in a movie, people are going to flock to see it. So I think this is a perfectly good opening for, you know, a middle of the summer movie with a no-name director with sort of a vague premise and following up on another Snow White movie just a few weeks earlier. So I think it's a perfectly fine opening. Does it have legs? I don't know, but we'll find out.
Well, okay, so it made $100 million.
I would not have greenlit it at $170 million.
That's where I was headed. It's a $170 million movie, and it made $100 million in its opening weekend, so figure it'll make $400 or $500 million worldwide when it's all said and done, theatrically.
Well, I don't know if we can come up with any multiple based on opening weekend for worldwide box office. They do that a lot in North America. They say, well, typically you'll make 3 times, you know, your opening week. It depends on the movie and the type of film and when it opens and how big and all that sort of stuff. This isn't a movie that was a guaranteed big opener where you could say, all right, everybody went opening weekend, unless it has great legs, it's going to do X amount of dollars. I think this is a sort of an unknown property. You got to see how it does.
You know, you made that little, I don't want to say mistake, but mental flub there with Kristen Stewart and Kirsten Dunst. In Cannes, of course, they were both in On the Road, and they were both on the dais at the press conference, and it really was confusing.
you on the left.
Yeah, you with the dark hair. Okay, now you, the one that was sitting next to Lars von Trier last year. It was kind of very interesting and funny to see different reporters and journalists try and keep it straight.
Well, that's the sort of thing that agents, managers, and film studio executives need to get right.
I guess that was your way of saying we should probably talk about a few studio executives. Like, I'm going to say just off the top of my head, well, Universal, you know, they're doing well over there now that they have this whole Kristen Stewart, Snow White and the Huntsman film. So that's probably what you want to talk about. Is that?
No. I want to talk about Alan Horn taking over Disney.
Oh, okay. I guess, yeah, the biggest news story of the week you'd like to talk about?
That's right.
Okay, just checking. Yeah, so, you know, we've already, you know, you'd have to be living under a rock to not know that.
No, I don't think that's true. Most people will not be aware that this happened. This is an industry story. It could go in inside baseball. Alan Horn was a longtime executive of Warner Brothers, paired with
Barry Meyer.
That Barry Meyer? Is that his name?
Yes, Barry Meyer and Alan Horn. Now, they took over for another duo that was at Warner Brothers and headed up Warner Brothers for a very long time, Terry Semel and Bob Daly. And
yeah, they were in charge for decades.
Yes, I mean, they had a great relationship with Stanley Kubrick, with Clint Eastwood, with a lot of talent. And then they were replaced by Alan Horn and Barry Meyer. They retired at the same time. Terry Semel went off to run Yahoo, or as many people like to say, run Yahoo into the ground as its CEO. And Bob Daly went off to head up the Los Angeles Dodgers for News Corp. And of course, once it was sold, he was no longer the head of the Dodgers. So,
another duo took over. Alan Horn was the COO, and Barry Meyer is still the CEO of Warner Brothers.
Right, and I guess Alan Horn was kind of pushed out in April of 2011 over there at Warner Brothers.
That's right. So he's been out of a job for over a year now, really.
Yes, but what I was referring to when I said you'd have to be living under a rock is not Alan Horn necessarily, but the fact that Bob Iger came in, he fired Frank Rich.
I don't think so. And you say you'd have to be under a rock. No, exactly. These executive shuffles are not known by most people. They're only important to people in Hollywood. Disney is such an iconic name that having somebody come in and be in charge of the movies at Disney is sort of big news. It's certainly for the industry. Most people wouldn't know about it, but what they want to know is how will this affect them? Do they care that Alan Horn is in charge at Disney? What does it mean?
Well, by Frank Rich, I actually mean, and this was I think it's the caffeine. I'm going to blame the caffeine on this. I meant Dick Cook. He was the longtime chairman or head of Walt Disney Studios under Eisner, and Bob Iger came in and let him go. And many people thought, hey, that's not a really good move since he has so many ties to the creative community and people love him. The creative community loves him. Iger, the CEO of Disney, then installed Rich Ross, who was the head of the Disney Network and the Disney Channel, and that was an untested, unexperienced studio head in the film world, who then hired M.T. Carney, an untested, unexperienced marketing executive. So there was this whole kind of novice team running the studio, and that didn't really work out so well, especially when it came to a movie like John Carter.
Well, I don't agree with any of that. I mean, you know, you run a successful cable channel, that's a big property worth a lot of money. They produce TV shows, TV films. I think the skill set can transfer over to a studio.
Well,
people have to get experience some point, some way. So I don't think he was given enough time to succeed. But
well,
anyway,
I would actually agree with that, with a caveat. I would say that it's one thing to go from the head of a network to a film position, but to actually head up a studio, it is a bit of a difference. And I do think that if you are a talented television executive, that is something to be. I mean, I think Rich Ross, wherever he lands, and he will land somewhere, he's going to do a great job because it'll probably be in television. And let's face it, there are few people that have his kind of experience in television.
Right. Well, so Alan Horn has taken over, but he was the COO, which means he's sort of the numbers guy. I know he was involved in forming Castle Rock, which is the company that Rob Reiner formed. That
yes.
was, you know, sort of rescued by When Harry Met Sally and helped launch the TV series Seinfeld, among other stuff. So he does have good creative relationships, I guess. But is he more of a numbers guy or do people like him?
People actually like him. I think reading Patrick Goldstein in the Los Angeles Times, he quoted somebody as saying when it comes to this particular hire that the creative community was actually ecstatic. And as one agent put it, quote, "It's like James Dolan hiring Phil Jackson to coach the Knicks. You feel like Disney is back in the game."
Okay. And of course, he said he'll be making about 6 to 8 movies a year, not counting Pixar or the Marvel films, which are the biggest properties that Disney has. But Pixar will be reporting to him.
That's right.
Pixar was not reporting to Rick Ross, right?
I think they were. They were reporting kind of in a parallel, you know, yes, they were reporting to him at the end of the day. And I think John Lasseter had a lot of say over the firing of Rich Ross, and apparently he complained quite a bit about M.T. Carney and Rich Ross, and that was what helped Iger make that decision to move to a different executive to head up Disney.
Why did he have complaints? They didn't mess up any Pixar releases, did they?
I don't necessarily know. I mean, I couldn't say. I'd have to go back. I think it was more a matter of what was the last Disney animated film?
Brave is coming up, the Cars 2, which did pretty well worldwide.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to go back and see what the exact complaints were. I know that certainly...
And Tangle before that, which ended up being a success. But the important thing is that he's, you know, he said, oh, I hate the word report, but Pixar will report to me.
Right.
So it's like he hates the word and yet he wants to use it. So he's making clear that, you know, Pixar and Lasseter report to him and he reports to Iger. So, you know, they don't think that they're on an equal footing with him. And he made that very clear in the most polite way possible.
Right. And that is what he's known for, is being very polite and very, he's kind of an old school executive. Now, just a day or two before, the Disney CEO, Robert Iger, was talking to the Sanford C. Bernstein Strategic Decisions Conference. And he said that he wanted two animated films a year, one from Pixar and one from Disney, and possibly two from Pixar if things go well. And that in addition, he said, quote, we intend to make two Marvel films a year. And that slate is well defined for the next few years. And he said, you know, we're not going to make 24 films a year or more than 24 films. But he didn't say they weren't going to make 23 films a year. But I find it interesting that he said that a few days before hiring Alan Horn. So he's really kind of in a way saying, look, I'm the one calling the shots here, and here's what we're going to do. And I'm going to put Alan Horn in charge here to actually see that strategy through.
So we'll see. He's got a lot of movies on his plate already, like The Lone Ranger and Oz, The Great and Powerful, both of which are scheduled for 2014, and Maleficent with, Julia Roberts? No, who is in Maleficent? I forget. But he's got a lot of very expensive properties, not even counting, you know, Captain America 2, Iron Man 3, Thor 2, the next Avengers movie, which they're thrilled to make, of course. And of course, all the Pixar movies. So, you know, he doesn't have a ton of wiggle room. He's got a lot of big properties already committed, already big dollars on the plate. You know, he's got to make them work because they're going to be released under his tenure. You know, they've been greenlit before he got there. But now, frankly, you know, he's in charge. So he's going to have to make them work.
Right. He's going to have to figure out a way to market them. And I keep going back to this Patrick Goldstein article, because when Horn left Warner Brothers, he actually sat down with Patrick Goldstein at the LA Times and had an extensive interview. And he really opened up and he said that, you know, first off, that Horn was known for these event films. So he oversaw the Harry Potter franchise. He oversaw the Batman franchise. So he was kind of known for bringing in these family-oriented event movies. And he told Goldstein that he was very proud. Horn was very proud of, quote, of having a role in creating our big event strategy. When I came to the studio in 1999, we only had one event film, The Perfect Storm. And over the years, we evolved to the point where we had six or seven each year. And it kind of underscores what studios are doing these days. They are making event-driven films. They're not there to win an Oscar.
Well, they can do both, of course.
Of course. But I mean, you know, he was instrumental, speaking of, you know, being a numbers guy, he was instrumental in doing away with Warner Independent Pictures.
Well, that was never a good fit for them anyway. Warner Brothers was a studio that was known for having long-term relationships with big stars.
Right, Clint Eastwood. You know,
Clint Eastwood, they messed up their relationship with him a little bit, crazily enough. But they, you know, they were known for big stars, big relationships, making big movies. That was their thing. So to also try and do indie, tiny little micro-budget movies, it's just not a good fit. It wasn't what they did well. So I don't think it's a rejection of independent films so much as them saying, look, that's not what we do well. It doesn't mean that Disney didn't have a good fit for Miramax for a decade or so, because they did. But if that's not your skill set or you don't have the right executives in place to handle that, you shouldn't be wasting your time doing something you're not good at.
Right. I think this is going to be a good fit for Disney. I mean, Horn was always known as somebody who put the studio first and was actually...
Over what?
Over, you know, gee, we can make money even though this film doesn't fit the studio. So, for instance, he was a little nervous about making and releasing The Hangover because he thought it would tarnish Warner Brothers' image.
Well, and Disney's not known for making Oscar-winning movies. They're known for making big event films.
Right.
Big, broad family movies. So, you know, it's a good fit.
And as Goldstein points out, as everybody pointed out here, is the only big question, and I'm quoting Goldstein, is whether Horn at 69 will be a short-term fix or end up as a studio fixture. Because after all, Iger is slated to leave the studio in 2015, which gives Horn a small window to work his magic before a new Disney czar takes charge.
Why is Iger slated to leave at 2015? Is he that old?
No, I think that was his deal when he took the position. He said, look, I'll only be here for 10 years, and then we'll get another CEO. That was the way he wound up getting that role, as I understand it.
Okay.
But, you know, a lot of this, I've talked to three or four studio executives and studio heads both before and after this decision was announced.
When do you talk to studio heads?
Oh, you know, I have my ways.
Do they all go to Starbucks?
No, they do. That's actually very funny. No, they don't, although that might be a good place. Yeah, my kids play on a few T-ball teams.
And what are they saying?
Well, beforehand, some of the studio executives and studio heads that some of whom, by the way, will now be reporting to him. So I might add,
we're thrilled that he's been hired.
And some of them who were offered the position or who were in the running for it, but said, you know, frankly, they didn't want it. They said this is a babysitting job where they have to babysit DreamWorks. They have to babysit Pixar. They have to babysit Buena Vista. And it's basically a big managerial job, not necessarily a creative position. And, you know, who would want this job? That was what was said beforehand. Then Alan Horn gets hired, and that talk kind of dampened down a bit. And people said, look, you know, if this turns into a babysitting job like we all expected it to be, well, Alan Horn can probably do that. But hopefully with him being, you know, holding the reins there, it will turn into something more than that.
They're hoping that for him or because they want to see more movies made. Disney has not been making a lot of movies lately, and they want to see more live-action Disney films get made. So, I mean, there's plenty of room for him to show creative spark by greenlighting some live-action movies.
I think it was a bit of both. I think that a lot of people felt he got short shrift over at Warner Brothers when he was pushed out in April of 2011. And I think that for the industry at large, hey, people want to see Disney making more movies.
Yeah. What about George Lucas? Will he be making more movies?
I don't think so. I think if he does, they will be smaller in nature as he has.
Oh, God, please. Don't buy that malarkey.
Well, he's always said, I want to make smaller films.
He's always said that for 30 years, buddy. He's a billionaire. He can make any movie he wants. The reason we're mentioning George Lucas is because he has hired Kathleen Kennedy to be the co-chair of Lucasfilm, his company, because he's planning to retire. He's going to slowly step down and he wants to put someone in place to take over his empire, which includes production facilities and special effects companies and sound companies and animation and a book publishing arm. So he's got a big empire and he wants somebody to look over it. And that's going to be Kathleen Kennedy. Good choice.
Yeah, I mean, look, certainly George Lucas and Kathleen Kennedy go way back. She was one of the producers on Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And she's been working with Steven Spielberg with her partner, Frank Marshall, for many years.
That's right. So it's not as if they don't know each other. So in a way, he's hired an unfireable executive here to do this because, you know, they go way back. I think for Lucas, as you say, Skywalker Sound is the post-production facility. Industrial Light Magic is his special effects house. Those two businesses have become very, very crowded with competitors at this point. It used to be ILM was the only place to go. Then it was ILM and Weta Digital and Digital Domain. And now there's so many different places to turn for special effects that they're just one in a number of companies that can do the job.
And yet they all get work because there's so many movies with so many complex effects that when they're trying to get a movie rushed to done, everybody gets a piece of the pie.
That's right, actually. It's very common to say, well, we're doing our effects at ILM, at Weta, and three other houses.
Mm-hmm. The question is, what is she taking over? She's just going to take over these, you know, these post-production facilities. Lucasfilm does not have a single film or TV show in the works. I mean, they have stuff technically, but they have nothing in active development, nothing being ready to shoot, nothing being distributed, nothing. They have nothing going on.
I agree. I mean, certainly it's like managing an estate. It's saying, you know, look, we have all of these properties. We have Indiana Jones. We've got we've got Star Wars, of course, and we just have to manage those properties.
All we can hope is that he'll retire and she'll say, don't tell George, but let's release Star Wars on Blu-ray. Since she refuses to release the original versions of Star Wars on Blu-ray, refuses to release the Indiana Jones movies on Blu-ray for some bizarre reason. People have been waiting for them for a while.
Well, I can tell you why the original Star Wars trilogy.
Because George Lucas is a schmuck.
No, actually, having worked for the company that did the cleanup, they actually refurbished the original Star Wars trilogy back in 97 through 2001. Yeah. They don't have the opticals. They don't have the original negative opticals the effects. Yeah, it was because he did want.
That's not why. You take every element that you have and you make the best possible negative that you can and make that your Blu-ray. Of course they can do it. He chooses not to.
Well, yes, they could. They spend $20-30 million to do that? Absolutely. But he's decided not to do that.
It is not a financial decision. It is him choosing not to make it available. He's done that for decades. It isn't a new thing. He's got all the money in the world. It's not because he doesn't want to spend all the money. And it wouldn't cost $30 million. That would be a massive restoration cost. It wouldn't be $30 million. They're turning them into 3D anyway, so they're dealing with all the negatives anyway. You tell me they've got the ability to turn Star Wars, the original movie Star Wars, into a 3D film, but they can't release it on Blu-ray? Give me a break.
Well, actually, as late as last year, I was talking to the person who was in charge of refurbishing the films for their 3D, you know, conversions, and he was actually interested in turning the original films back into 3D, not the 2000 series, and they explored trying to do that, and it was prohibitively expensive, and they couldn't actually find all
Trust
of the
me,
opticals
there's
and elements
of negatives out there of the original Star Wars to create a terrific looking Blu-ray. He simply has not bothered to do it. It is not that they can't gather the material from around the world. George Lucas said, you know what? I want to refurbish Star Wars, the original one. He could do it. And shame on him for being so stupid not to make sure that they had good prints available and stored. I find that a little hard to believe.
It's not the prints. It's the actual optical effects.
I find it a little hard to believe they weren't preserving all that all along, since they've been refurbishing and retouching and redoing and reissuing them constantly since they were originally released in 1977 and on, that they were able to do a special edition, re-release in theaters, and a special edition in theaters, special editions on Laserdisc, special edition on VHS, special editions on DVD, special editions on Blu-ray. You tell me they can do all that, oh my God, it's too hard. That's bullshit. That is not why they haven't done it. That's ridiculous. George Lucas has angrily insisted he won't do it. That's the only reason they haven't done it. There's other reason.
Maybe he's just
upset. Every movie in the world can be restored. It can be restored as good as possible. Even if you have, you know, a silent film, you put up a still and say, 10 seconds of footage is missing. If that's all you got, that's all you got. But trust me, that would not be the case with Star Wars.
Well, maybe he's just upset over that South Park episode where the kids went and chased down Lucas.
And pretending it's a technical reason that his hands are tied and he has no choice. That's not it at all. That's not true. It would be difficult, onerous, expensive. Sure. Would it be worth it financially? Absolutely. Is he not doing it because of some technical snafu that he can't overcome? No. He just refuses to do it. That is the only reason. Please admit that's true.
Well, I do think that George Lucas is, you know, very opinionated when it comes to this kind of stuff. But at the same time, I, you know personally the executive.
Nobody said it's not easy, but they restore silent films from 100 years ago. Of course they can restore Star Wars. It is not some impossible task. He refuses to do it. That's the only reason it hasn't been done, period. Don't tell me that Star Wars is not available to put out on Blu-ray. That's ridiculous.
Not the original version.
Of course it is. Of course it is. You tell me that with the 10,000 prints of that movie and all the optical effects and all the information available at Lucas's fingertips that he can release a special edition, but he couldn't possibly release the classic original edition. And if that was the reason, he would say, God, guys, I'd love to, but I can't.
Well, actually, when they were trying to do this, this particular person that I was speaking with,
they weren't trying to do it. They've never tried to do it. He's adamantly refused to do it. He won't do it. Don't tell me his assistants, they all tried to, but he's now...
No, it's not his assistants. It is the group.
It's not... He's never tried to do a restoration of the original Star Wars. He doesn't want to do it.
Well...
It's not that there is some thing holding his hands and he refuses to admit it because he's embarrassed or ashamed, or he just doesn't, you know, hates to break the bad news to us all that Star Wars is lost forever. It's not lost forever. Trust me. That's ridiculous. It's difficult and expensive.
I don't know how much I'm allowed to say about this because this wasn't necessarily being said in confidence to me, but at the same time, I didn't say, hey, I'm going to go and repeat this a year later. But this person was actually putting together pieces of the original Star Wars to try and figure out a way to refurbish it for video only, not for re-release theatrically. And the only way that they could do this was to go back to release prints, so not negative, was to go back to release prints to get some of the effects. And that was the problem.
Happens all the time.
And it just did not look good enough. And so even he's a big fan of the series, this particular executive said, you know what, actually, it can be done, but it's going to be really, really difficult. And frankly, it's not going to be the same because we would have to recreate all of these effects.
They slapped crappy looking unmastered versions of the original movies on the DVD release or whatever release of the Star Wars movies begrudgingly. They could have touched those up and cleaned them up without having to have anything else available to their hand. They couldn't even be bothered to make them look nice. So this is disdain. It is not some technical snafu that has George Lucas handcuffed. This isn't greed, Von Stroheim's greed with a missing 5 hours. It's Star Wars. They would figure it out.
Greed, you should explain, is a big silent film.
Yeah, it's like 8-9 hours long or something, and we're missing about 6 hours of it.
Which some people would say is actually a blessing in disguise.
Maybe. Oh my God, no, Greed is a great film. It's really entertaining. It's fun. Well, you know, there you go. Anyway, sorry about all that, guys, but George Lucas is a schmuck. Moving on.
In other news, actually, why don't we move on to theater news, where a film that was a little bit smaller in nature back in 1997 was a film that I saw. It was a documentary called Hands on a Hard Body. And I thought this film was going to be, you know, what, like 10 minutes long? Because, you know, how could you actually make a whole movie about a bunch of people in Texas standing around a pickup truck with their hand on it, and the person who stands there the longest and doesn't move their hand off of it wins the truck?
Now, that's a stunt done by local car companies to gain attention for their car companies or for their sales or whatever's going on. You get on the radio. And this was a documentary, right?
It was called Hands on a Hard Body. And I think it initially attracted attention because people thought, hey, a hard body. And then, no, it's not about, you know, people's hands on a beautiful woman. It's about people's hands on a truck, basically.
Right. And wasn't it at Sundance, or where was it at?
I can't remember, but I remember helping bring attention to this film, a creative artist agency, when I was there. And it wound up being put onto This American Life, a section of it, just the audio portion. And it, because of that, it wound up being this huge hit.
That's what helped launch it?
Well, it got a lot of attention from This American Life, and that's what gave it the... I mean, there has been talk of turning this into a feature film for years, ever since 1997, right, when it was on This American Life.
Right. I remember it played the LA Film Festival. It wasn't Sundance, it was LA, and it won the Audience Award for Best Documentary. And then that same year that the audio stuff was used on This American Life.
Right, and I saw it at the
LA Film
Festival.
Robert Altman was working on it, wasn't he, at one point?
Yes, that's right. And it was while at the LA Film Festival that I kind of raced out and said, this is a great movie. We should, you know, we have to find a source material for new fiction films. This could be one.
Oh, so it wasn't that you were taking the filmmakers, you were taking the project to CAA.
Yes, correct.
Oh, cool. All right. And, well, you know, that's what happens. A lot more films get developed than ever get turned into a feature film. So it's not unusual that a feature film didn't ultimately result from this, though it's an interesting concept. But what's happening to the movie, to the project now?
Well, it's not going to be turned into a feature film. However, it does seem like its next natural progression would be Broadway musical.
People standing with their arms on a truck, standing on a Broadway stage, bursting into song.
Yes, because nothing says musical like a stationary 4x4.
So where is it happening? What's it going? Is it opening off Broadway? Is it opening around the country? What's happening to it?
Well, from what I understand, right now it's playing at the La Jolla Playhouse, which is where...
Oh, it's already out. It's happening right now in California.
Yes, and La Jolla is known as kind of it's where Rent was performed before it went to Broadway.
Rent?
Rent, yes.
Rent.
Rent. I'm pretty sure, yeah.
You don't mean the, like, Angels in America or something, or...?
I don't know. I'd have to go back and check, but I remember, you know, I knew a couple people who starred in the original, and I believe they were at La Jolla first.
All right.
Now you've got me wondering.
So no, that was at the New York Theater Workshop. I mean, that, I remember that it vividly.
It was there as well.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I remember that vividly because I almost went to that. My friend went to that and talked about it. I was going to interview Larson, and then he died. I mean, I was very, very, we were on top of that show from the beginning. I can't imagine it played at La Jolla. I mean, it just doesn't even seem possible.
Well, Michael Greif was the kind of artistic director down there at the La Jolla Playhouse. And he
terrific
also
talent, yeah.
And he also directed Rent. So maybe that's what I'm confusing.
Yeah, that was started here in New York. That was a New York show down to its roots, you know. And that, the very first thing was the New York Theater Workshop. I did an oral history about it for The Advocate. That did not play in La Jolla.
Maybe that's what I'm probably, well, you know what did play in La Jolla is a show that's on Broadway right now, Jesus Christ Superstar, the revival.
Oh, did it start in Toronto and then go to La Jolla, or did it start in La Jolla and go to Canada?
It started in Toronto, went to La Jolla, and then from La Jolla went to Broadway.
Yeah, La Jolla is a big launching pad. So right now they're showing the musical Hands on a Hard Body. Are there any names in it?
Well, I believe Keith Carradine is in it. And of course, he won a Tony for Will Rogers' Follies. Hunter Foster from You're in Town and Connie Ray from Next Fall. And I love the fact that they say, you know, that the book is by Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Doug Wright. And the music is by Trey Anastasio. I can never pronounce that name, who is, of course, from the band Fish. And and the music is also by Amanda Green, who helps write the lyrics. But then the musical staging is by, and this is a quote, Benjamin Millepied, best known for his choreography in the movie Black Swan. Frankly, I think he's best known for being Mr. Natalie Portman.
I've never heard of him.
He is Natalie Portman's husband. So,
all right. Well, but then he has other credits to his name than Black Swan, I assume. No,
I assume is, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't give him this job because he's married to Natalie Portman.
No, not at all. No, he's all a choreographer. So,
yeah. And Doug Wright is an extremely talented playwright. I Am My Own Wife is one of the great one-man shows that I've ever seen. So it's a good cast, a good team behind it. It's an unusual idea for a Broadway show. But when's it? It's playing La Jolla right now. Is it scheduled to come to Broadway, or do we have a date?
2012-2013 season.
So this fall or next spring sometime?
Correct, yes.
All right. What else can we look forward to on Broadway?
Well, speaking of good playwrights, I've heard that this guy, I don't think he's around anymore, this Tennessee Williams cat, I think he's got a future, from what I understand, or at least his work does, because they're going to be performing this Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. I don't know if you're familiar with the work or whether you've...
Well, I am. The movie version is, like a lot of his plays, was bolderized, so you lose the whole gay subtext of the play, which makes it interesting. Brick, of course, is a gay character in love with another man, and he cannot perform with his wife. So all that is lost in the movie with Paul Newman, which is a shame because it's a very interesting play and those were great actors. So who's going to be talking these iconic roles on Broadway?
Well, there's talk about Scarlett Johansson, who, of course, has already won a Tony in 2010 for playing the sheltered niece in A View from the Bridge. And Chris Pine, of course, probably best known for Star Wars.
Star Trek.
I'm going to go with Star Trek on that. He's there's rumors about whether he'll be in it. And Jeremy Renner
There's talk.
There's talk, yeah. I mean, basically yeah. that he's in talks to star opposite.
Okay, rumors sounds like you're on the street and people are whispering or something. Has Chris Pine ever done any theater? I mean, I actually like him quite a bit in movies. I don't know that he's ever done any theater particularly. I know he's on ER. I know he's done TV movies. I don't know if he has any theater credits. I mean, I'm sure he did something in high school or something, but that's an interesting thought. He's certainly good for the role, and Jeremy Renner would be his amour, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Chris Pine perform on stage three times at this point.
In like events or actually in a full-blown production?
In full-blown productions. I saw him.
So he has done theater. So what did you see him in?
You know, I saw him in Farragut North.
Uh-huh.
Which was turned into Ides of March, which was the...
George Clooney film.
Yes. Yeah. And I saw him in... Now, you're going to have to forgive me. I always get these two plays mixed up. The Cripple of Inishmen.
Yeah, that's a play.
And it was the one... He had an Irish accent, and he was a gangster.
Okay.
Was, like, upset that his cat was missing.
Was he good on stage?
He was fantastic in both of them.
Terrific. Well, he's never made it to Broadway, but that'll be interesting. And he's a talented actor, obviously. He's interesting. Though I did just see This Means War, and boy, is that an awful, awful movie, even by the low standards I had for it. A romantic comedy with him and Tom Hardy and Reese Witherspoon. Dreadfully. I mean, just incompetent.
Well, now, this is going to kill me. I think it's the caffeine that is causing me to not have a memory. The Cripple of Inishmen. Was it the Lieutenant of Inishmore?
Well, those are two different plays.
Actually, it was the Lieutenant of Inishmore, not the Cripple of Inishmen, both of which I've seen. He played the gangster who his best friend is a cat, and the cat dies. So,
well, that's upsetting. Speaking of death, Death of a Salesman just ended its run on Broadway. It was a huge success. It was sold out basically at the end, doing tremendously good business. It starred Philip Seymour Hoffman and Peter Parker. I mean, Andrew Garfield. And, you know, Mike Nichols directed it. Certainly pegged to be probably the winner for best revival of a play. And it was a huge success, and it was setting records week after week towards the end. Now, how can you do that? You're a Broadway show. How can you set a new record for top grossing show week after week? Well, you just keep raising the prices. They only have a certain number of seats. But producer Scott Rudin said, hey, they were looking at all the credit card purchases and they could see they were being bought in Connecticut, New Jersey, where scalping is legal. And so they said, well, screw it. If they're going to charge $1,600 on a scalping company for tickets, why don't we charge $500? So they were charging $499, a new Broadway record for a ticket price for a show that beat the old record set by the producers way back a decade ago, when they charged $480 and people's heads were exploding that they would do such a thing. Now, a straight play, five people in the cast or six people in the cast, $499. I guess $500 was too much.
Yes. Well, you know, I guess that was the producers. That was back when Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick were performing in it, correct?
Of course. Absolutely. Yes, okay. It was the hottest show in history.
Okay.
Yeah. And Scott Rudin says, oh, we only did it because of scalpers. He said, we felt we weren't squeezing anyone out by raising our prices. That's what he told the New York Times. Because we were playing only seven performances a week instead of the usual eight, our decision to raise some ticket prices for the final performances was also a way to make sure people involved with this production were being paid instead of the brokers. God bless him. And of course, by people involved with the production, he means himself.
That's right.
Because
yes.
They certainly didn't bump up the salaries of Philip Seymour Hoffman and Andrew Garfield. They just gave themselves more money. And the problem with this is that a couple. One, if they want to stop scalping, because scalping is legal in Connecticut, New Jersey. If they want to stop scalping, they have the right to sell tickets to people and say, hey, you got to show a credit card or ID when you come to the theater. It takes 2 seconds. If people could avoid paying $300, $400, $500 for a ticket, I bet they'd be glad to do it. You know, they could take simple, easy steps to stop scalping. I mean, why not do it?
Well, you know, part of the issue is that some of those tickets go to the hotel. So the hotels buy them for their you know, patrons. And then they say,
Well, hotels aren't handed tickets. They are allowed to buy tickets.
That's
just
right.
Like everybody else.
That's right. Yes.
That's fine. But they don't have to be paid. They don't have to be handed a bunch of tickets. It's not like
So let's say you purchase the ticket from your hotel, from the concierge at your hotel, and then you show up and they say, well, where's the credit card that purchased this ticket? Well, I don't know. The concierge over at the Hilton has it.
A, there's simple ways of B, if they don't want the hotel to do that, they don't have to. A hotel shouldn't be a reseller of tickets. You know, if you want to get a ticket to a Broadway show, buy a ticket. If the Palace wants to provide tickets or the Biltmore, they can figure it out. And there's ways to say, add an individual name that night or whatever. You could do it for your big customers. But are they funneling tickets to hotels? Well, that's anger. It makes me angry anyway.
Yeah,
Why should people staying at the Four Seasons get access to top Broadway shows when I can't? If a show's sold out, it should be sold out. I don't know if the Four Seasons buying that. They're sending people to scalpers and brokers. They're not buying tickets directly.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been in that side of the business.
They send them to broker. They say, you want tickets to show? They get them from a broker, pay $1,000 and hand you your ticket and charge you to your hotel room. They're not going to Broadway houses, lining up, buying tickets and setting them aside. They're sending it to a broker.
Decades ago, of course, and this was from the book Ticketmasters, and you might recall we had the authors on the show a while back, that was one of the ways the box office managers made money, was that they would kind of sell tickets.
Illegally, they would take tickets on their own and sell them, resell them to the hotels.
Right.
They were breaking the law. So the one problem is that they want to stop scalping. There's a lot of things they can do. Number two, when they're charging $500 for a ticket, that makes brokers and scalping and all this not seem so bad. You say, well, golly, if I walk to the box office here, I'm paying $500. So I guess $300 for this ticket to this show isn't so bad. So it inflates the prices for everyone. If you want to fight scalping, put the steps into place that you can that will stop it. You don't have to charge $500. If you want to be greedy, that's your choice, but don't pretend you're doing it and your arms are tied. Scott Rudin is only helping himself, nobody else involved in the show.
Right. And he has a fiduciary responsibility to the investors of the show to make as much money as possible. So I'm not condoning
it. He can charge $10,000 a ticket to a show if he wants to, but don't pretend he's being forced to do it by scalpers.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Now, what do you think a ticket to a show that features and is about and stars Mike Tyson would get?
$10.
Well, we've talked about this before, that Mike Tyson did this 1 week run of Mike Tyson Undisputed Truth. He did that in Las Vegas, and people said, well, hey, maybe he'll take it to Broadway. Sure enough, that seems to be exactly what's happening with Spike Lee, the filmmaker, taking it on as a director, potentially. This is being reported by a
number. I don't know director at all. That wasn't in the original report. That was, he just said Spike Lee's involved. The Niederlanders are involved. This was according to Mike Tyson. So there's nothing official. Nobody's announced anything, but, you know, it seems possible. Maybe Spike wants to be a producer on it or something. I don't know why. It got indifferent reviews in Vegas. So why anybody would want to bring it to Broadway? William Shatner just brought a one-man show to Broadway. It played for a couple weeks and then died and disappeared. You know, this is just something to fill the theater during the summer hours.
I saw that, actually. I saw the William Shatner, the one-man show, and it was interesting. Did you see it?
No, I did not.
It was actually, I mean, it really humanized him. And he
I like William Shatner, but it's not necessarily a Broadway show.
Yeah, well, I have to say he did a very, it was basically, here's my biography as told by me. And it was really fun, very funny, and he did a great job. And, you know, he kind of talked about, and we shouldn't go on about this, but
well, he's done stage work throughout his life. He's had stage presence. Mike Tyson is not a stage actor. He got poor reviews in Vegas. So why would you want to bring it to Broadway? The reason is you've got an empty house. The Niederlanders own the palace.
That's right.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is leaving the palace on June 24th. Annie, the musical, the revival, arrives in October, which means you have July, August, and September where the palace is sitting empty. Mike Tyson is over here saying, I'll give you some money if I can go to your theater. And they're saying, okay, Mike, give us your money and we'll let you be in our theater for a couple of weeks. So they're going to shove this show in there. It's a terrible space for a one-man show. It's a massive, gigantic space meant for big musicals. So to put a one-man show in it is just awful. It's a terrible, it's the worst venue you could pick practically on Broadway. But it's available. He's going to go in it. He'll lose money and everybody will be happy.
First off, I like your Mike Tyson impression. I thought it was pretty good, actually. And secondly, what you're saying is he's not going to win any Tonys.
No, certainly not.
But
we do know who will win the Tonys. The Tonys are this Sunday. Neil Patrick Harris is the host, of course, because you have to have a gay man host the Tonys. And I think in about 120 seconds, we can tell you who's going to win every category.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I wish I had a timer here because I would, you know.
Don't hold me to it because I might go long. Best play is going to be very, very tight. I predict it'll be Clybourne Park because that's the show I would vote for. But John Robin Bates has a big following. It could be other desert cities. And Peter and the Starcatcher does have the most nominations. So it's possible that that show could win. And Frank, if you look at it, that show has two strong nominations in acting. So I think, you know, there's only four shows nominated. So it's not much of a thing to pick half of them. But I'm going to... I'm gonna stick with Clybourne. You know, I'm gonna go with Peter and the Starcatcher because I think that show really needs it, and I think they have a love for it. And it's a celebration of theater. So I'm gonna say in an upset, Peter and the Starcatcher wins Best Play. Best Musical is easy. It's Once. That's facing off against Newsies. Newsies is the show about newspaper kids going on strike. Once is the Hollywood film turned into a musical. It's one of the best musicals I've seen in years. It's gonna be a close call, but I think Once will triumph. It's just too good a show. Best revival of a play is easy, Death of a Salesman. Best revival of a musical, easy, it's going to be Follies, which Broadway people just love. Personally, I would vote for Porgy and Bess, and Evita is the real winner because it's a massive commercial hit. I don't know why, but there you go. Follies will win Best Revival. Best actor in a play will be Philip Seymour Hoffman in Death of a Salesman. Best actress in a play will be, I think, Nini Arianda in Venus and Fur. That was a star-making turn. If there's an upset there, it could be Tracy Bennett as Judy Garland, Stockard Channing. This is the tightest race practically of the night. Best performance by an actor in a musical. I'm going to say, you know what? I think we're going to crown a star. I think Jeremy Jordan might just pull it off for Newsies because I think they're going to want to recognize that show. And, you know, and he's a Broadway baby. He was in two shows this season. I think he could do it. Best actress in a musical. That's tough, but I think it's going to be Audra McDonald. She's never won an actress Tony, even though she's won, I think, three Tonys. She's one of the most lauded performers in Tony history. I mean, she's finally going to win a leading role Tony.
And Best... Kelly O'Hara has probably already won a Tony.
I'm not sure, but she probably has. I think maybe she won it for South Pacific, but we'd have to check. Best performance by a featured actor in a play. This is all over the place, but I'm going to say Christian Bale for Peter and the Starcatcher. He stars in the NBC show Smash. Featured actress in a play. This is another tough one. It could be just about anybody, but I'm going to say it's, you know, people are loving our Death of a Salesman. I didn't like Linda Emmond. I thought she was the weak link. Judith Light is a favorite, but I think she's just a little light, but we're going to be crowning another new kid if we make this pick. But I think it's going to be Celia Keenan-Bolger, who's really charming in Peter and the Starcatcher. She's practically the lead role. Best performance by a featured actor in a musical. It could be anybody. It could be just about anybody.
Well, it's not going to be me because I wasn't nominated.
You're right. I'm going to say Philip Boykin for Porgy and Bess. Could be Michael Cervaris for Evita. You know, they love him.
Well, I know you like Josh Young as Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah, I do, but it was a bad show. Michael McGrath is sort of a Broadway veteran. I'm going to go Michael McGrath for Nice Work if you can get it. It's a hit. Same thing for featured actress in a musical. That's tricky as well. A lot of good performers. It's not going to be Divine Joy Randolph. It's not going to be Jesse Mueller. I don't think it'll be Elizabeth Davis in Once, because she really should be the lead. I think it's going to be Judy Kaye in Nice Work. I think that sweeps the supporting performance roles. Best Book of a Musical, Once. Best Original Score, it's going to be Newsies, because yes, it's practically the only one on there. Best Scenic Design of a Play, it should be Once. But I guess it's going
to
be...
It needed to be nominated for it to be Once, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's going to be One Man, Two Governors. Best Scenic Design of a Musical, it should be Once. And I think it's a bar, though. I don't think they're going to be wowed enough by it. Will they give something to Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark? I don't think so. Ghost is very busy. That's a big, elaborate set. I think they're going to go with Newsies. Best Costume Design of a Play, One Man, Two Governors. Best Costume Design of a Musical, Follies. That has great costumes. Lighting design, you know, we're getting into the tech awards. We don't care anymore, do we? Lighting design could be anything. Sound design, direction of a play. This is what matters. Direction of a play, Mike Nichols for Death of a Salesman. Direction of a musical, John Tiffany for Once. Best choreography, Newsies, because it's the show with the most choreography in it. So there you go. I think Newsies will win a lot of supporting stuff like choreography, and I think it'll snag a best actor. Peter and the Starcatcher will be an upset in best new play, and Once will be the winner for best musical.
Okay, so I guess when it comes to Broadway, the Tonys are a big deal.
That's right. There's no bigger deal.
That's right. And that was my way of segueing into our weekly segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Netflix has just zoomed past Apple's iTunes to become the main supplier of streaming movies online. In subscription video on demand, it's 10 times the size of its nearest competitor, Hulu. Overall, including sell-through and rentals, Netflix owns 44% of the nearly $1 billion market. That's $1 billion spent on movies to buy or rent or view online, doubled from 1 year earlier, and is expected to double again as DVD and Blu-ray sales continue to slow down. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal, mostly for the size of the market and how much it's growing, not for the fact that Netflix at this certain point has this percentage of the business. That'll change with time. As other competitors come in, but it's a big, huge, growing market.
The season finale of HBO's Game of Thrones reached a series-high 4.2 million viewers. The medieval fantasy has been growing steadily since its debut, and HBO says it is now the third most popular series in HBO history, which means it is presumably right behind, the Sopranos and Sex and the City. Add up all the viewers who have watched the show on HBO to HBO Go and DVR and the like, and HBO says this season it is averaging 10.3 million viewers compared to the 9.3 million viewers of season one. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I think it's a big deal in the sense of the 10 million viewers. I mean, the actual numbers on Sunday night when the episode debuts don't matter. HBO doesn't care about that because they're not in the ratings game. They're in the subscribers game.
That's right.
And when you add, you know, they can add it up. They don't have to explain themselves to advertisers. They can say, hey, look, we added up everything. Everywhere this show is available, we've added up, and it looks like there are about 10 million people watching us each week. You know what? That would be a top 20 show if it was on the primetime channel. Those are serious numbers in this day and age. And I think that's how you quantify how many viewers are watching a show. That's what you should do for everything.
Now, and, let me say this. You know, if it was on a cable network or a
major network, yeah,
it would not have nearly as much nudity.
It would not. No, this just show is the lamest excuse for nudity since Skinamax.
Right. Now, speaking of numbers, Oprah Winfrey is relaunching her book club with the memoir Wild by Cheryl Strayed. It tells the story of a woman who goes on a 1,100-mile hike through the Pacific Crest Trail following the breakup of a marriage and the death of her mother. Because that's what I do, you know.
When my mother dies, I'll go jogging.
Yeah. In a video first posted on the New York Times website, Winfrey said she was reading and loving the book and wishing to heck she could make it her next pick. So she did. Oprah.com will reveal a host of digital info on June 4th. An interview with the author will appear in O, the magazine, in July, and a TV interview will air on OWN in late July. Readers who access the book digitally on any platform can access a reader's guide and personal notes from Winfrey about her favorite passages. That's just what I want when I'm reading a book. What did Oprah like? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for the publishing industry. Obviously, they're thrilled because Oprah Winfrey can name a book and make it sell a million copies. What's going to happen with this book? That's certainly going to be a big question mark because she doesn't have that platform of her TV show anymore. So it'll be interesting to see how much of an impact she has on sales. But what's fascinating about this is the way her fortunes have changed. This was announced on the New York Times website with a video, not on her own website, not on the OWN network, on the New York Times website because she wanted the biggest audience. She's not an idiot. She wants a big audience to know. She knew it would be big news, but she went to the New York Times, and that's where she announced this. So that's kind of telling about where she is as far as, you know, the platforms that she has. She's leveraging them. She's using Oprah.com. She's using the magazine. She's using the network, but she started with the New York Times because that's where the eyeballs are. And I'm also fascinated by the digital version of this book and all the extra she's adding into it, like her comments, like, oh, I love that chapter. I cried right here. Who knows what she'll write? But it's fascinating that she's adding those little extras to make the ebook a little more special and a little more personal to her. Why not take advantage of it? It's interesting. I can't wait to see how many copies this book sells.
Andy Samberg and Kristen Wiig, two of Saturday Night Live's biggest stars, they're both saying goodbye to Saturday Night Live.
Is the show still on the air?
It still is on the air, believe it or not. Wiig had said for a while that this was her last season and that the time just felt right to leave. Samberg hinted as much in one of his bits on the season finale, and now it's official. Wiig, of course, had a major success with Bridesmaids, while Samberg has always been the quote-unquote potential breakout star, thanks to all those digital shorts that have gone viral. His final short? Lazy Sunday 2, with Samberg and Parnell reprising their breakthrough hit. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You know why? Because Saturday Night Live will survive. It doesn't matter who leaves this show. It continues to draw huge ratings. I don't know why, but it's the definition of an institution. Kids watch this show and think it's funny. It astonishes me, but there you are.
It's the Energizer Bunny of television shows. Woody Allen listed the cast of his latest untitled fall project. It includes, in alphabetical order, Alec Baldwin, Kate Blanchett, Louis C.K., Bobby Cannavale, who we all know from winning Tonys, Andrew Dice Clay.
Oh, my God. Andrew Dice Clay.
Well, Andrew Dice Clay, we might have to explain who that is to some people.
Oh, my God. He's a moronic stand-up comic who traffics in stupid, vulgar, stereotyped humor, which he likes to pretend is just a sham. He's making fun of himself, but he's just a buffoon, and I can't believe he's in a Woody Allen movie.
Hey, you never know why. You never know. Michael Emerson, Sally Hawkins, and Peter Sarsgaard. But the real shocker, I thought the real shocker was Andrew Dice Clay. It's set in the U.S., specifically San Francisco and good old New York City. Sure,
yay!
Whatever Works was set in New York, but that was so awful, it almost doesn't count. What we remember are the seven other films trotting around from London to Paris to Barcelona, and I guess this year it's Rome. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Back in New York, finally, after three or four films, and really seven or eight if you don't count Whatever Works. So it's nice to see. And, you know, if you're a movie buff and you read Variety as a kid like I did, and I imagine you did, seeing untitled, they would list, you know, in the days before the internet, they would just list movie projects in development, things that were about to shoot or were shooting or had finished but hadn't come out yet. And you would see there for ages, every year you'd see Untitled Fall Project, written and directed by Woody Allen. And you look at the cast, it just warms your heart to see Untitled Fall Project. In fact, if I made a movie, I might call it Untitled Fall Project.
Actually, I think it's Untitled Woody Allen Fall, you know, with the year. But yeah, I mean, you would always see that in the production books. Yeah. Now, part one of the Hatfield and McCoys, that miniseries that's, I don't even know what cable channel it's on, but it's on some cable channel.
The History Channel.
The History Channel. 13.9 million viewers, a record for a non-sports show on basic cable. Part two scored 13.1 million, and part three, 14.3 million viewers. All three ranking as the top three non-sports shows in the history of basic cable. Big deal or big whoop, Michael? I mean, I guess it's a big deal, otherwise it wouldn't be here.
Well, not. I mean, we sometimes include things that aren't big deals. We include big whoops, so it's absolutely a big deal. Number one, it's a Western, so that's great. Number two, it's a miniseries, so that's great. Miniseries have been out on the outs for a long time. This is a huge success for them. They're just starting to launch themselves in fictional programming. It didn't get great reviews, but, you know, you had big stars, and it was just a monster hit. So I think, you know, I remember Broken Trail back years ago on AMC. That was an out-of-the-box hit and a terrific movie, by the way. With Robert Duvall. If you're looking for a good Western to watch, rent Broken Trail. So this is great for the Western. It's great for the miniseries. I think it's good news all around. We have another sort of Western called Longmire, which debuted on A&E just a few days ago. That opened to really strong ratings, the best ratings in A&E's history for an original series. I think it had like 4 million viewers. So that's about a sheriff out in, you know, in Wyoming, and it has a Western feel to it. It's contemporary, but it feels like it's a, you know, set in the Old West sort of feel. So I love Western, so I'm glad to see it.
Hey, Springsteen. Here's $10. That may not sound like a lot, but it could add up. That's the hope for Ardio, the music subscription service, which is lagging behind Spotify and Rhapsody. They hope to increase users by paying artists $10 a head for every subscriber they bring to the service. Obviously, a big star like Lady Gaga could potentially bring in a flood of new and paying users, but it's more likely the offer will appeal to indie and regional bands who could fantasize about bringing 5,000 fans to the site and actually, you know, making $50,000, but probably won't. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's not a big deal. It's not a big whoop, though, either. It's sort of down the middle. It's another revenue stream. It's like the artists got to do everything. They got to record their own album. They got to release it. They got to do the PR. Now they got to bring fans to the quote unquote radio station to listen to it. And, you know, but at least they have a chance to make money doing it. So it's a tiny little revenue stream. Maybe it'll help some people. Whether it works out and actually, you know, profits anybody, I don't know. But, you know, we'll have to see. Any money they can make helps.
True. Now, Universal, we talked earlier about, you know, how
What a schmuck George Lucas is with his old movies. And he keeps fiddling with them and won't let us see the original version.
Well, okay, that's one way to put what we were discussing earlier. Universal is putting out a newly remastered version of some of its greatest films to celebrate the studio's 100th anniversary. Paramount, by the way, is also turning 100 this year. We've already seen a terrific Blu-ray edition of Jaws and another one of The Sting. Now, we're getting one for E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which is due out in October. But best of all, the guns have returned, so there are now guns back in E.T. For a 20th anniversary celebration of the movie, first released, you know, back in 1982, Spielberg made numerous tweaks, such as updating E.T.'s face and changing the weapons in the hands of police officers into flashlights, because that seemed realistic. But for the new Blu-ray release, the weapons are back, and fans will see the movie in its original edition. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop because back in 2002, when they released that version on DVD, they included both versions. Unlike George Lucas, Spielberg said, hey, I want to make these changes, which I'm like, you know, hey, I thought they were dumb changes. Basically, overall, there's no point to mess with the movie. It's not a great movie because of its special effects. But OK, he wanted to make the changes. He made the changes. He offered that edition. But alongside it was a beautifully remastered copy of the original film. So when I got that nice new DVD in 2002, it contained a DVD with the film in its original form. So I never had to watch the version with flashlights because that's stupid. So I actually looked at the changes because I was reviewing it. But I had a beautiful, pristine copy of the movie the way it was originally released. He can make 18 versions of E.T. if he wants, as long as he continues to make the original edition available. And at the time, I said, hey, Lucas, this is how it's done. You want to fiddle with your movie? Fine. You want to make an 8-hour black and white version of Star Wars? We don't care. We'll go see it. Just let us see the original version as well.
Yes,
so it's
I
a
agree.
Big whoop because they've been available all along.
Spartacus, the TV show that put the Starz channel on the map, announced the upcoming season beginning in January would be its last. I'm glad I know now 7 months before I actually need to know. It's titled War of the Damned. It wraps up the slave revolt in typical bloody fashion. The show airs in 150 countries and will have produced 39 episodes, including a 6-episode prequel after the original star got sick and ultimately died. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I'm not quite sure what's going on here. I don't know why I'm suspicious. Normally, I like to take people at their word. They said, hey, you know, it's a big show. We want to end up on top. We want to finish on top. We've got 6 million people watching this show last season per episode. I think that's also an average based on multiple viewings. I don't think that's their original air date viewership, or they would have been in the top 15 of cable every week, and they weren't doing that well. But hey, this was a breakout show for Starz. It's probably very expensive to make, but they're in 150 countries. So I imagine they have to be making money on it. So I'm not sure why they're shutting it down after 10 more episodes. What seems to be the case and what they're saying is we just sort of ran out of story.
Yeah.
They said, you know, we've got the slave revolt. We're already out there with the slave revolt. We know where it's going. We can't add a new stuff. You know, we know what's going to happen. And basically they said the next few years, if you look at it militarily, are just like, this revolt is there and it's crushed, and that revolt is over there and it's crushed, and they go back over here and they go back over there, and finally there's one big final bloody battle, and Spartacus loses, but somehow it's hopeful. So they've just said, we're going to just combine it all, make it one big final battle, show how close the slaves came to overthrowing Rome, let him die, but become a heroic symbol, and just wrap this puppy up. So, you know, 39 episodes for a show that's making money and doing well, it seems astonishing that they would pull the plug, but apparently they're doing it, and apparently it's for all the right reasons.
I am Spartacus.
Exactly. I just read a book, by the way. It's going to be available on June 12th as an ebook. It's also available in paperback, but it's an original written by Kirk Douglas about the making of Spartacus and the breaking of the blacklist. This is, you know, he's had a number of books and memoirs published. I've never read any of them, though his first memoir, The Ragman's Son, got great reviews, and I've sort of wanted to read it. This book is about 250 pages, and it's a lot of fun. It's all about the making of Spartacus and breaking the blacklist, and it's him dealing with Kubrick and him dealing with Laurence Olivier and Charles Laughton and all these people and casting the female lead and having to fire her. It's a very fun, entertaining, well-written memoir about that period that focuses in on it and gives you a real sense of what it was like probably today even, but dealing with all the egos of all these stars and studio executives and runaway budgets, because he was a producer on the film as well.
That's right.
So if you're a fan of Spartacus at all, the original film by Kirk Douglas, and I don't love it, I like it, but it's better than most sword and sandal epics, but it's not a great movie in my mind. But it's an interesting movie, and it's the first film I saw in New York at the Ziegfeld. So I have a fondness for it. And this book was terrific. Very well written. A lot of fun. I'll be reviewing it for Huffington Post. But if you're looking for an ebook, come June 12th, check it out.
Actually, I saw Spartacus at the Ziegfeld as well, with the intermission, in fact.
Oh my God, we might have been sitting next to each other.
Possibly. Who knew? Who knew? Back in the 90s. Well, now let me ask you this. Who is the king of late night television? Is it Leno?
Leno?
Letterman, maybe?
Yeah.
Nope. It's Terry Moran.
Who?
Yeah, I don't really know who that is. Well, yes, Moran, along with Bill Weir and Cynthia McFadden and Martin Bashir, are the team on ABC's Nightline. And in the all-important May sweeps, Nightline was the most popular show on late-night television, reaching an average of 3.9 million viewers. Before you dismiss all the news junkies as old fogies, Nightline also won the 18 to 49 demo. So that's big news. Leno scored 3.6 million viewers and Letterman 3.1. Thanks to Nightline, Jimmy Kimmel reached 1.9 million viewers, beating the 1.7 million of Jimmy Fallon and the 1.5 million of Craig Ferguson. That was a lot of numbers there. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal, obviously. That's a new king of late night in the May sweeps, too, when everybody pulls out the big gun. So that's kind of amazing that Nightline did that. Oh, my God, they're doing construction right next to me. I hope you can hear that. I'm very proud of Craig Ferguson, who seems to have a better hold than Jimmy Fallon on the viewers that he's handed. Slightly better. I think Craig is the best late night talk show host right now, and I wish he'd do even better, and he's probably the heir apparent to Letterman, but all praise to Nightline. And they did it when there was not even a huge news event going on. You know, that's kind of what's really remarkable to me. Nightline tends to perk up if there's some big crisis or some big international event that's going on that people want to go and see something nightly substantive about the event. In this case, they just did it as part of regular May sweeps. You know, more power to them.
Yeah, good for them. Well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into...
I was just going to eat some cereal.
You really want to cover this story? Okay, fine.
Just very quickly, very quickly.
Fine. Disney executives stood next to the First Lady last week, Michelle Obama, to announce that they will be banning junk food ads on all of their kid-focused entertainment outlets, such as the Disney Channel, Disney Radio, and ABC's Saturday morning lineup of kid shows. No heavily sugared cereals anymore. No junk food high in sodium and sugar everywhere. You know, Disney also committed to improving the nutritional quality of food served at its amusement parks and perhaps tellingly launched a program where anyone's food offering could be Disney approved and get a quote-unquote Mickey Mouse logo indicating it's of decent nutritional value. So now you can have your Disney stamp on everything. Disney chairman Bob Iger, who we've talked about way too much in this episode, has said that the health food for kids has become, quote, a very, very solid business for Disney. This is not altruistic, he said. This is about smart business. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. It's kind of astonishing. I can't imagine it happening 20 years ago, but I made a mistake there. The logo program has been in place for a little while, and apparently they say just, you know, billions of pieces of product of fruit and vegetables have been sold with the Disney-approved logo on them, indicating they're of good nutritional value. So this is a business they're already in. They're getting a little kickback every time something healthy is sold with their logo on it, and they're expanding it to their, you know, cable channels. the Disney. I mean, what do you advertise on those channels? Can they not advertise dumb toys? That would be a nice step forward too. But I think it's very interesting, and I think it's obviously true. He's saying, look, they're not doing this to be nice. They think they're going to make money out of it. So long term, they think it's going to be to their benefit, and it certainly would be to the benefit of kids.
Now, I only buy Mickey Mouse stamped apples when I go to the grocery store. Where are my crickets? Where's my cricket sound effect? Well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop and moves us along, as I tried to move us along earlier before we had to cover Disney cereal, to, you know, we're going to talk about some inside baseball. That's where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you, our listeners. And this week's story is really about piracy. When all is said and done, it's about piracy. And William Morris Endeavor, because of course Endeavor Agency and William Morris, they merged, and Ari Emanuel is the head of it now. And Ari Emanuel, if that name sounds familiar, it's because, well, first of all, Rahm Emanuel, who used to be the chief of staff to President Obama, is now the mayor of Chicago and is Ari Emanuel's brother. And the agent on The Entourage was modeled after Ari Emanuel, but he's kind of a big deal here in Hollywood because he's a big agent. And he went to the All Things D conference last week, and he said, point blank, I'm going to piss a lot of people off. That was a direct quote. And he's known for having a bit of a foul mouth and a bit of a temper. And he said, where Google decides to play in this piracy issue, plus Verizon, AT&T, is very crucial for our industry, and I'm concerned they're going to wait it out. Now, what he was referring to was this whole piracy issue. And he was talking to Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher, the founders of All Things D. And he says, if they don't, and he was referring to Google, stop the stealing of content, I think it is going to be a problem. We need Northern California to figure out how to keep our intellectual property from being stolen. If Google was in China and their stuff was being stolen, they would leave China, right? And then he went on to basically say, look, ask Google, ask Verizon why they haven't come to the table and sat down with us yet. So that's what Ari Emanuel said. That was earlier in the week.
Right. So my reaction from not really reading what he said was like, he seemed to be saying, come on, just stop the piracy, make them stop, which seemed kind of stupid. And people said, do you yell at the people who build the highway for the criminals that drive on the highway? Or do you yell at the people who created the phone system for somebody calling you and pulling a scam? I mean, they're just providing the structure and the road work. They're not doing the bad things. They're not responsible for phone calls that are made or people who use the road to go rob a bank. It's not their problem. That was the response that I think a lot of people had.
Well, and then Google, in the middle of the week, releases their transparency report in which they say, okay, here are all of the URLs people had us take down over the past year. And so we're not censoring. We want to let you know what the
Well, they are censoring. They did what they... Well, they're not providing a list of them on their Google search. So, I mean, they're self-censoring.
Right, but they're also only taking down links to URLs that had copyrighted or copyright-infringing material. So, you know, basically,
or at least people claim that there was copyright infringing material.
Right.
Because we've had stuff taken down when it was perfectly public domain, but they just assumed it was breaking copyright.
That is correct. But in this case, the number one, I mean, they had like umpteen million URLs removed. So of those millions of requests, Microsoft, believe it or not, is the number one complainer of copyright infringement, asking that a total of 2,544,000.
No, 2.5 million.
Thank you for correcting that. Yes, 2.5 million URLs be removed. The irony is those same URLs, which are now, you can't find them on Google. So these are all, you know, URLs to Xbox video games or software that is being pirated. They can be found on Bing, Microsoft's own search engine.
Why would they not remove them off their own search engine?
I have no idea.
Just incompetence, right?
Yeah, they're just a company that's way too big for its own good. Now, coming in behind Microsoft...
So this is Google mocking Microsoft and other people, saying, yeah, all right, we've done what they said, but they're not even doing it themselves, and doesn't any of this make any sense?
Well, they basically said, here's our report. Do with it what you will.
Okay.
And of course, every journalist went and said, well, okay, Microsoft asked for all these URLs to be taken down. Where else can they be found? Oh, on Bing. And Google knew that would happen. Also, NBC Universal, the RIAA, BPI, which is the British Recorded Music Industry trade group, they have all asked for lots of URLs to be taken down between July and December of 2011.
Well, I'm sure they do it even before and after that. This is just what the report covers.
That's right. Now, so basically what they were saying to Ari Emanuel is, hey, shut the in your language, F up, because, you know, we are actually helping in this war against piracy. And Ari Emanuel then responded by saying, and this is a quote, I'm going to read it straight. He said, "I am misinformed about a lot. Just ask my wife. But I'm not misinformed about this. One of our last remaining dominant American exports is our creativity, no matter how you define it, either as a story or as an algorithm. There is equal genius behind companies like Apple, Facebook, Amazon, and Google, as there is behind artists who create stories that resonate around the world. We need to protect America's intellectual property, and Hollywood can't do it on its own. I understand that the onus is not entirely on Google's, but let's stop talking at each other and get in a room with all parties to figure this out. To be clear, I don't want to rehash SOPA," which is the Stop Online Piracy Act, by the way, "as we can all agree, that was a reflection of Southern California's arrogance. And let's also not pretend that we're working together on this issue because we have YouTube channels together. This is a larger conversation. It's time for Hollywood, our government, and Silicon Valley to step up and collectively resolve this problem. Let me know where and when, and I'll be there. Ari."
Well, you know, I thought he was a bit of a schmuck in his first comment, but I think that's a fairly reasonable statement.
Right. And I think in an interview setting, that it kind of came off as, you know, kind of pompous and jerkish, and it
well, he had something like, there should just be a button that you should do and get rid of piracy or something, you know.
It didn't come off right.
It was technologically stupid. But I mean, it's true. I don't know what the tech world could do to help work with Hollywood and the government to try and prevent piracy and make it less legal. I know people who've who steal music online. I don't have to do it because I get a lot of music for free from the record labels. But I know people who do steal music and do steal books all the time. They never buy a single book. They just steal the ebooks. They're all available right away. They steal music constantly. And I know there's some people with some music websites that are pirate websites. They've been telling me how they're having a little bit extra trouble. Like the companies that provide the downloads keep changing every month or two, where they used to be there round for 6 months or 8 months, they're getting shut down quicker. So they have to keep signing up with credit card information with a new company so that they can get access to all these downloads. I've heard that people who download music illegally find that iTunes is not recognizing it, and they have to take an extra step of taking the music, burning it onto a CD, and then ripping that CD onto their hard drive and putting the music back on their computer that way in order to sort of get it recognized. So it seems like they are doing some things to try and combat piracy. And there are things like that that are perfectly reasonable. You know, you should make it hard for people to steal property if you can, because it harms everybody.
Right. And I would agree with Ari Emanuel. As I have always said, you know, what would really work is if you got everybody in the same room and said, okay, how do we solve this together? What are you going to do? What are we going to do?
What can we do? And they've just done such a bad job because they've antagonized Silicon Valley with SOPA, which was moronic and stupid.
Right. And I think, you know, Ari Emanuel is now kind of saying, yes, that was dumb. So let's put that behind us. Let's move on and, you know, get together. So, okay, great.
Do you think it will have any effect? Is he powerful enough to help spur that on?
Well, somebody's going to have to be a proponent of it, and it may as well be him.
At least he curses.
That's right. You know, at least he's a colorful character, as they say. Kind of like us this week. You know, I have to say, my brand new coffee meter is on low.
Uh-oh, so we should get them. Yeah. I've started drinking coffee in the last 6 months too, the last year. So funny enough.
Yeah, it's totally addictive and I don't even like the taste of it. And yet here I am needing more coffee.
Well, I drink decaf. Coffee. I don't drink caffeinated.
Ah, okay. I definitely drink the caffeinated kind, and I can definitely tell my caffeine meter is running low. So
before you brew any more, tell us about how to get in touch with the show and how to rate and rank us and meet us and find us online.
That's true. I should tell you that we can be subscribed to the show, that is, on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher. I don't even know if the Zune Marketplace is still around with E3 and Microsoft announcing their whole Xbox program. Who knows? But, you know, go to some of these podcast aggregators, iTunes, Stitcher, the Zune Marketplace. Subscribe, rate, and review the show there. We really appreciate it. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can tell us what schmucks we are for calling George Lucas a schmuck, so feel free. You can find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode. They can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to contact us and even ways to follow us. We're on Twitter. Showbiz Sandbox is the username to look up. We're also on Facebook, where our Facebook page can be liked. The name to look up, ironically, Showbiz Sandbox. All of that information, again, is on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael can be found online at his new Twitter handle, kicker or no kicker.
No, just kicker, no kicker one.
Okay. You can find Michael there or on his website.
MichaelGiltz.com.
That's right. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.